The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
We're just over a quarter of the way through 2019, but the mad scramble for 2020 is already on, as President Trump would say, bigly. With a single no thanks from Stacey Abrams, Democrats are lining to run for a Georgia seat in the U.S. Senate, while would-be members of the House are piling up in both parties. And a retiring state Supreme Court justice opens the way for another high-profile battle. Glad to have you back with us for another Political Breakfast. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is back. He's a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff to former Governor Nathan Deal. Democratic strategist Theron Johnson has been called away, so joining us this time, former Democratic Congressman Buddy Darden. Welcome to both of you.
Good to be here.
And Brian, congratulations on your induction into the Grady Fellowship at UGA's Grady College of Journalism and Mass Communications.
Thank you. It's a great honor. I love my school, and there are so many mentors and heroes in that fellowship that I've looked up to since I was in college, and many of them have come on to be friends. And so it really does mean a lot to me, and it was a great evening, and I just am so thankful to the people at Grady College.
And we have to start with Stacey Abrams' decision not to run for the Senate against David Perdue. Congressman, you've been involved in candidate recruitment a time or two. You know how Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, felt about Stacey Abrams. He really wanted her to jump in. He promised her and gave her that State of the Union response speaking slot. Do you think that now his nose is bent out of shape after her decision?
Well, I've known Chuck Schumer for almost 25 years. We served in the House together, and we've stayed in touch when he comes to Atlanta for fundraisers. So he and I have more than a passing acquaintance. And Chuck Schumer never gives anything without receiving something. So I think he's probably somewhat disturbed. And just as of last week, he told Teresa Tomlinson that she needed to hold off until he heard from Stacey for sure, still thinking that she might run, just last week.
Teresa Tomlinson, former mayor of Columbus, who has now jumped in. I asked Stacey Abrams, though, specifically about this back in February. I was filling in on All Things Considered. I specifically asked her, did you promise Chuck Schumer anything? And here's that exchange. Did you give him an assurance that, okay, the Senate is the race I will pick to run in next in order to get that speaking slot?
Absolutely not. I was pleased that before he and I had a single conversation about my decision to run for the Senate, both he and Speaker Pelosi offered me that opportunity. I think they wanted me to provide the rebuttal because I reflect the continuing evolution of our party.
You're telling me he did not ask and you did not offer to say, I will commit to the Senate race?
Not at all. And again, before we had a single conversation about the Senate, he made me the offer, and I was very pleased to accept.
So, Congressman, that's her story, and she's sticking to it.
And it may be true. However, I know Chuck Schumer, and he doesn't give something away without expecting something in return and believing he's going to get it.
Do you think, though, that Stacey Abrams is being accurate when she says, look, they offered me the slot before we even talked about the Senate race?
I'm not in a position to say, except that there was high expectations by Chuck Schumer she would enter it.
Absolutely. Stacey Abrams has been a helium balloon within the Democratic Party, rising. At some juncture, you reach a pivot point, and do you continue to rise or do you begin to fall? And you know, right now, her former opponent, Brian Kemp, his approval ratings are actually going up, and her approval ratings are going down.
And now she becomes yesterday's news. And we Democrats want to move forward. We've got a candidate who's already announced. I talked with her this morning, and she's on fire. So we'll see where it goes.
Like, I think Stacey had an opportunity here. And I always said on this show, she can't wait 3 more years to run for governor again. You can't sustain that helium balloon for that long. Mm-hmm. And so what she has done now is undermine what she has built, which is admirable. She has built a national fundraising base and built a national profile on The View, on late night shows, on the Sunday morning shows. I mean, she's everywhere. She's much more high profile than the guy who actually won the governor's race. She's got to figure out a way to sustain it, and I think that this cuts off that flow. And that's why she's drug it out so long, I think, because she knew there was going to be a price to pay. And Buddy's absolutely right. She was not given the biggest plum that the minority out of the White House party has to give, which is the response to the State of the Union address. It was a very high-profile night. She was the toast of the town. Everybody was talking about her. Those opportunities are going to disappear, and she's got to go figure out a way to remain relevant for 3 more years if she's going to run for governor. Very hard to do, and her platform for doing it, this Fair Fight group and these other groups that she has put together, are pushing divisive issues, not unifying issues that will help her politically. She is just going to harden the Republican opposition to her and I think alienate some of the middle ground voters.
And she called for unity, and actually she did what I thought was a very good job when she gave her response to the State of the Union, because she called for unity and Democratic unity. However, now it's time to move on for the Democrats.
Absolutely. That's bad news for Stacey Abrams, man. I mean, talk about somebody with so much potential, so much ability, and I just don't think she's played her cards very well in this instance.
Is there anything, though, to the thought that as she watches people like Beto O'Rourke, for instance, who at least for the moment were the shiny object du jour, and now he's struggling in the polls, at least as a presidential candidate.
A lot of parallels.
But however, as Martin Luther King said, Dr. King says, God's not through with it yet. And I'm sure that she'll land somewhere. She has a unique ability to move and get herself in the right position. So she'll be okay.
I think the Beto O'Rourke example is one that Abrams can draw lessons from. This guy caught fire in Texas. The Democrats in Texas and nationally sort of gave him a much bigger platform than a normal challenger to an incumbent would get. And at the end of the day, what we've seen on the campaign trail is that he doesn't have a lot of substance. I mean, there's a lot of flash. There's a lot of cover model-ism, but not a lot of policy heft.
But she's very specific.
And she's got it. And she has, absolutely. She has got the policy heft, but now she's in danger of being seen the way he is, as a sugar high.
Congressman, then the question becomes for Democrats in this Senate race. Stacey Abrams appealed to progressives, even though she says, for instance, I'm a capitalist, I'm not going as far left as a lot of the folks say in the House. But you've got Sarah Riggs Amico, you mentioned Teresa Tomlinson, there's also the name of Michelle Nunn out there. These are people who don't have the same heft with progressives that Stacey Abrams does. So how do the Democrats tailor their message to their candidate and win statewide against a well-funded incumbent in David Perdue?
Well, now I've got a disclosure to make in it. I'm on board already with Teresa Thomas. I've known her for many years, and I think she needs a chance to get out there, and I think people will be surprised at her charisma and her ability to bring people together. She was a very successful mayor for 2 terms down in Columbus, gets high marks there. And David Perdue is smart not to underestimate her. And we'll just see, because she is the outsider now, and David Perdue has become exactly what he ran against 6 years ago. So it's a wonderful dynamic out there, but Democrats have got to sort through it, and we've got to decide on a candidate. I don't think you'll see Michelle Nunn out there. I don't know about Ms. Amico, but I think Teresa Tomlinson is the candidate right now that Democrats think has the best chance.
And Brian, other well-known names in the party including some rising ones like Jen Jordan, but also Jason Carter and Michael Thurmond have already said, nope, I'm taking a pass on this.
Right. All of those would be interesting, particularly Michael Thurmond, because he brings something to the table that the other two you mentioned do not, and that is he's African-American. And
where, he's run statewide, as has Jason Carter.
And he's got a lot of bipartisan appeal. You know, I mean, even though he's from the most Democratic county in the state as far as votes delivered in statewide races, he is my CEO, and he's done a great job. And so I think there are a lot of white Republican voters in DeKalb who think very highly of him. And, of course, he's got bipartisan appeal on a statewide basis. I mean, people just like him and respect him because he's got a record of competence. And he didn't really run a race against Isaacson when he ran against him in 2010. His name was sort of on the ballot because he was sort of a team player.
Neither one of them said anything bad about the other.
Right. And there was no campaign run.
And just recently I spoke to both of them about the idea of listening, and they both went out of their way to say nice things about each other.
Yeah, they're great. I think it's such a telling thing that Abrams feels the need to come out and reiterate that she's a capitalist. I mean, how crazy. I mean,
well, it's not that crazy, because the problem is this, as you well know, we are being painted, we Democrats are being painted as socialists slash communists, and some of our people have given the other side a lot of ammunition to work with.
That's exactly right. We're quoting people, not just painting them with it. We're quoting what they're actually saying. Going back to the Senate race, if a high-profile good candidate who's African-American and a progressive gets into this race, is going to be a major problem for Tomlinson or Ossoff or anyone else who is white looking to get into that race. And we saw last year what Stacey Abrams did to Stacey Evans, who is a highly accomplished, very smart, decorated legislator who is white, though.
And who has already made her own plan. She's not looking at this race. She's signed on to John Barrow's campaign for state Supreme Court.
Yes. But in all fairness to what Brian is saying, there is no, in my view, high-profile African-American candidate right now who has stepped up to do it. This is a big, big undertaking for somebody to do. And you and I both talk with Michael Thurmond, we know he's not going to do it. We know that Jen Jordan has said she's not going to do it, even though she is not African American. We know that there are probably no one out there from the African American leadership group who has expressed any interest, in my opinion. So I think that you might have a fringe candidate too, but I do not see an major African American candidate in the race yet.
You know, one thing that's happening in the General Assembly as far as the Democratic bench, and this is something that I've said on this podcast before, is who's going to run for the Democrats? They don't have any legitimate people kind of waiting, and that's beginning to change now because their number of seats in the General Assembly has grown, and so you're seeing more in-town, more moderate folks taking seats as Democrats. So their bench is growing, and that's going to make a major impact going forward.
So, Brian, I hear you saying perhaps that whatever the national trends are among Democrats and whatever the accusations that Republicans level against Democrats nationally, we will see a more moderate strain of Democrats here in Georgia.
He's right, because look at the senators, the women senators who have made such an impact. Zahra Karinchak from out in Gwinnett County. Look at Sally Harrell. Look at, of course, Jen Jordan. And our bench, and I'm glad Brian pointed that out, is beginning to grow, because you've got to beat somebody with somebody. You just can't all of a sudden say, you're in, and that's it. Let's look at John Ossoff. Regrettably, even though he made a great run at it, he had no prior track record.
And didn't live in the district.
That's not a crime. Bob Barr didn't live in his district. David Scott doesn't live in his. I mean, it's a bipartisan thing. Brian, Democrats could go after Senator Perdue, though, on what they would call his failure to deliver federal disaster assistance in a timely way to Georgia farmers devastated by Hurricane Michael. Now, whether or not you think that's a fair accusation, politically, is that an effective strategy?
I think the effective strategy is for David Perdue to ask every one of these Democrats, would you vote for an aid package to help Georgia farmers, even if it didn't have Puerto Rico funding, when they've got $90 billion already that they haven't done an effective job with?
That's a figure that President Trump has used, and at least some of the fact checkers say it's substantially less than that.
Democrats say it's more like $30 billion, but at the same time, what's the problem with Puerto Rico getting their money?
How do you spend $30 billion on an island and not make a difference?
Oh, listen, it's a big island, and they had total devastation. You can spend $1 billion just putting an interchange in I-85. It's easy to go. But what I'm telling you is that David Perdue should quit worrying about Donald Trump being somewhat dissed by the people of Puerto Rico, and vote, let Puerto Rico have their money too. Who cares? The point is the House of Representatives, the Democratic House of Representatives has already passed it several times with the aid to Georgia and the aid to Puerto Rico. So why can't the Senate, like Johnny Isaacson says, go ahead and give them their money? Who cares? Let's relieve our own people and forget about Donald Trump's peak at Puerto Rico.
$30 billion. And to downplay that significance is head scratching to me. And I think Republicans have a strong case to make. At the end of the day, the Democrats have chosen Puerto Rico over Georgia. Make the Democratic candidates take a stand.
They have made an offer, though. As Congressman Darden says, the Democrats have made an offer, and they could argue, hey, we put it out there. It's the administration that is blocking it. It'll be a battle over who says no.
David Perdue in the news this week is saying that they are getting closer. You're seeing Democrat senators such as Pat Leahy of Vermont saying we are getting closer. So I think they are moving towards some sort of a compromise. But yeah, at the end of the day, we're not asking for $30 billion here in Georgia. We're asking for a much less substantial amount of money. Give us our money and let's move on.
But if Senator Perdue is taking the time to say that, it says perhaps that he senses that he might be politically vulnerable on this next year.
It means that he and Johnny Isaacson and our House delegation know that our farmers have got to get this money. It is a do-or-die situation. And I think we're really off over the time of do-or-die. They are already hurting down in southwest Georgia.
Yeah,
so
our colleague Emma Hurt did a whole story on that just recently.
She did a very good job, by the way. I listened to it in its entirety. And as you know, the House of Representatives has already passed the funding that gives Georgia what it needs, and because of Donald Trump being snubbed and being criticized by the Puerto Rican officials, he's holding up the whole thing. And so David Perdue is voting against the people of Georgia because he doesn't want to offend his buddy Donald Trump.
Let's pivot now to the House. And Congressman, in the district that has the number that corresponded to your old one, the 7th, there is a pileup now of candidates in both parties because Rob Woodall, the incumbent, has retired. It includes parts of Gwinnett and Forsyth County. You got on the Republican side, Lynn Homrick, a former Home Depot executive. Of course, State Senator Renee Unterman will jump in. Former Falcon Joe Proffitt is in. Possibly former Gwinnett GOP Chair Mike Royal and former State Representative Scott Hilton. And that's just the Republicans. Are both parties at this point kind of looking at uncharted waters here? And you even have Lynn Homrick moving into the district. And on the Democratic side, John Eaves, former Fulton County chairman, moving into the district. It's a really attractive seat right now.
It must be because there's so much at stake here because, as you know, reapportionment takes place next year, and everybody wants to go ahead and get that advantage of incumbency. And this is a great prize. I feel almost sorry for poor Carolyn Bordeaux because she came within 500 votes, and now everybody's coming to the party.
And she's
some of them, I think,
too,
have rather unrealistic expectations when you run last in the race for mayor, for example, of
referring to Mr. Eaves.
Then you move out to Gwinnett County, expected to run for Congress. That's quite a reach. So some of these candidates shouldn't be taken seriously.
Part of what's happening there as far as on the Republican side, some of these in-town people getting pushed out into that race, is people were looking at the 6th Congressional District where former incumbent Karen Handel was back in the race. State Senator Brandon Beach is in the race on the Republican side to take on Lucy McBath. D.C. Republican circles have rallied around Karen Handel. And so they're saying, look, we're not going to help you. We're going to be against you if you run against Karen Handel. She's our person, and we're going to back her.
And Brandon Beach was in early, though, and he's raised
money. He was in before her. Yeah. So and we'll see what he does. Somebody's already declared for his state Senate race, so it causes some complications should he reconsider. Not that he is. But people are being pushed out into the 7th district. And it's one thing if you live a mile or two away. It's another thing when you move 30 miles away just to run in a district where you have no connection to that community.
But Lynn Homrick, A, has money, and B, has immediately staked out her allegiance to President Trump, which is going to play very well in a primary, especially if you have the money to push that message.
And let's see if she can back up any of that talk about Trump. From what I'm told, there's not a lot of evidence that that took place. She didn't vote in the primary in 2016. So that should raise eyebrows. In fact, she's never voted in a Republican primary. So those are things she's going to need to explain. If she's such a big Trump person, does she have a sign out in front of her yard? I don't think so.
The Twitter war has already started in that primary. Renee Unterman calling her the Buckhead Lady.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It should be a fun primary to cover.
Yeah.
It will be. And I think Senator Unterman thought that she would just walk in and the nomination would be hers, and she'd be a formidable candidate if she didn't have to spend all the time and resources in a primary. And that would give her a chance to kind of consolidate her support. But this is a very complicating factor to her to have a primary opponent.
A little history, though. Senator Renee Unterman, back many election cycles ago, ran what was at the time, I believe, either the most or one of the most expensive state legislative races in the country against Joyce Stevens in a Republican primary. They both spent boatloads of money. So she's no stranger to high stakes and high budget primaries.
Well, that's true. However, take my word for it, and my experience has been, is that there's nothing more divisive than a primary, because people get over general election feelings, but I think Brian will agree with me, but you never get over some of the raw nerves that come about as a result of a primary, an intra-party primary.
I tell you, you wear
Brian,
those scars.
Brian, you've had some recent experience there.
I've had many, many experiences there. I've got many scars to show from the primaries. But look, Renee would be a formidable person in that race, probably the Republicans' best bet to hold it, because it's a very competitive seat. She's never lost an election. She was able to spend $1 million when she first got that Senate seat, which has got to be 15, 16 years ago. It's been a long time she's been there. So her question has to be, do I want to be in Congress? Do I want to give up my seat in the Senate, where I have been highly effective on the issues that are of concern to me and for my county that I love? So I think those.
But she lost her powerful chairman slot.
Yeah, well, look, she started out the session saying they took everything but my underwear. That was her quote that I saw. But what happened over the course of the session was the new lieutenant governor, Jeff Duncan, began to see how effective and how tenacious and what a fighter she is. And notably, it was Duncan who went to her and said, I want you to carry this heartbeat bill, which was going to be a tough lift, and they needed somebody they trusted to do it. And Renee delivered on it. So she all of a sudden became a favored child in the Senate again. She returned to glory.
You're right. I don't think anybody else in the Senate could have carried that lift. She was only one of two Republican women. The other Republican woman has only been in one term, I think, or part of a term.
And so was against it.
I think that was an outstanding effort on her part, even though I'm totally opposed to the philosophical end of it. I think she ought to be commended for legislative expertise.
Congressman, on the Democratic side, we mentioned Carolyn Bordeaux. We've mentioned John Eaves, two of the candidates there. But you have indications of the diversification of that district with State Representative Brenda Lopez Romero, activist Nabila Islam, to name two, attorney Marcus Cole. All of these folks are on that Democratic side in addition to Bordeaux and Eaves. So this is going to be quite a Democratic primary. There'll likely be a runoff, and it's going to be fascinating to see who gets in.
Yes, it will be. And I was expressing some sentiment for Carolyn Bordeaux because she went out there first and ran such a great race. But by no means, politics is not a meritocracy, and she's not entitled to anything. And I think State Representative Brenda Lopez Romero will be formidable. I don't know the other candidates, but it's a new ball game, and certainly Carolyn Bordeaux can't afford to sit on the laurels. It's going to be a tough primary.
Yeah, and in the general, I think that there is an idea amongst Democrats and increasingly amongst many Republicans that the margins have collapsed so fast that this is now a Democratic district in 2020. I went back and looked at some of those numbers, and the fundamentals for Republicans aren't as bad as you would think. Brian Kemp actually outperformed Rod Woodall in that district on the same ballot. What you had there was Carolyn Bordeaux as a challenger, better funded and able to spend a lot more money than the incumbent Rob Woodall, who is traditionally underfunded. I mean, he's never been a big fundraiser. He's not a big he doesn't really like the political end of politics. He's more of a policy guy. And that really showed in that campaign. So she was up on the air running TV ads for weeks before he had a response up. And by the time he got up, it was too late. So that was one reason why it was so close. And yet he still won despite the fact that he was outspent so heavily. So a good Republican can still win that district. And then, as Buddy mentioned earlier, we get into redistricting and perhaps they can draw in some more of those Forsyth precincts.
Draw in all of Forsyth County is probably what they'll do.
To make it more Republican.
Republican.
If the Republicans control the House, State House.
Yeah, there's yeah, that.
There's
yeah.
that.
Yeah. And there are more races to talk about. We'll be back with more of The Political Breakfast. Stay right here.
You love free. And at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And we're back with The Political Breakfast. Thanks for staying with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare, joined this time by former Democratic Congressman Buddy Darden, filling in for Theron Johnson today, and Republican strategist Brian Robinson. Let's quickly look at a couple of other congressional districts where we're going to see primaries. The 13th, which is Congressman David Scott's district, former Democratic Cobb County Democratic Chair Michael Owens, going to challenge David Scott. Congressman Darden, you're from Cobb County.
That'll be a heavy lift. Michael Owens is a very energetic young man, and I think he's done well for the Democratic Party. However, David Scott is a known brand, and he's produced and delivered for the people of his district. He solidified his opposition over the years, and frankly, he would be very difficult to beat in a Democratic primary. He's old, traditional, proven, and Michael Owens has got the fire in the belly, but still, you got to have more than that.
But do Democratic voters now, especially newly registered Democratic voters, break along generational lines? Is it a young versus old voters thing, not only in this district, but some others?
That's what Michael Owens would like to make it. However, it'll be hard to see younger voters kicking out Scott as well, but I know them both. I know them well. I think a lot of both of them, and who knows, but still, you've got to look at the numbers and say that it would be very difficult for him to upset David Scott unless he goes after him really hard.
And as we mentioned before, if you look at the district, it's tough too because geographically it's a crazy quilt district and you have to travel a lot just to get around and get yourself known.
Michael is a friend of mine. He's a really smart guy and he's got a great job with young kids. I'm not quite sure why he's doing this because if you gave me the choice between depending on older voters or depending on the quote-unquote new generation of younger voters, I'm going to take the older voters in a primary every time because they're the ones who show up. And getting young voters, people under 40, to show up in a non-general election is extraordinarily difficult. That's why the MARTA vote in Gwinnett went down. It was older voters who really lifted Donald Trump up in the primary in 2016. The Georgia Republican primary, not, and I know we're talking about the Democratic primary, but our primary is very tilted toward people over 50 and then tilted even more to people over 65. So it is an older demographic that shows up in those races.
We've already talked a little bit about the 6th Congressional District on the Republican side. Whoever wins, though, is going to have an interesting bit of support. Whoever wins that Republican primary to take on Lucy McBath will have the support of the NRA, not only because Lucy McBath made gun control a key part of her platform in her race against Karen Handel in 2018, but the new president of the National Rifle Association is from Marietta, Carolyn Meadows.
I love Carolyn Meadows. I've known her, even though she's been a rank-and-file Republican, an original one going back to the beginnings of the party in Cobb, and I've been on the Democratic side. But at the same time, she was there in the district just like she was, and she's been on the board of NRA forever. So I don't think that this additional being the president is going to make any difference insofar as the outcome comes.
Brian, though, how tough a job will she have? Her plate's going to be full with NRA stuff. There are key questions about the future of the NRA and some of the NRA's activities that have been raised not only outside the organization by the New York State Attorney General, for instance, but from inside the organization. When you have Oliver North and Wayne LaPierre going at it, that's a clash of the titans inside the NRA. Carolyn Meadows has got a lot of stuff to tend to, whether or not she pays attention to Lucy McBath.
I have never been part of a political organization, and I would bet Buddy hasn't either, that isn't defined by its infighting to those who are in the organization. I mean, it is just how these things operate. So I don't really think it's out of the ordinary. The NRA is an esteemed, well-known brand. Carolyn Meadows not only has the stamp of the NRA, she also is on the board of the American Conservative Union. So she's on the Stone Mountain Memorial Commission here on the state level. So she's very involved in numerous levels and is a well-known name. But if you ever met her, you would never envision her as the leader of the nation's most well-known gun rights organization.
You don't
not at all. She was a Dodgin before she married, and that was a Dodgin Middle School, and that was a Dodgin Road out in Cobb County, D-O-D-G-E-N. And so she's well-beloved, and I really just don't think it's going to have anything to do with the correct congressional grade. But let me tell you what I heard the other day, and I'll let Brian comment on it, but I heard that Tom Price has had a poll done, and he is considering looking at maybe making a comeback in that district. Have you heard that, Brian?
What I have heard from reputable sources is that he's fully behind Karen Handel. That's what I've been told. So that is news to me, making news here, if that's true. I really did think he was with Karen. That they have a long-term relationship, and from what I've been led to believe, a close and good relationship.
In fact, he left his support of Governor Deal to support Karen Handel for governor in the primary.
I don't remember that.
Which didn't go down real well, as I recall. it caused the district to be changed somewhat.
I do recall something about that, Buddy, now that you say it.
Selective amnesia, right?
Good times.
Let's turn to another race very quickly. Justice Robert Benham, Justice of the Supreme Court. He has been Chief Justice at one point. First African-American Georgia Supreme Court justice, took his seat in 1989. He is leaving. This opens up a nonpartisan race nominally. And John Barrow, former Georgia congressman, Congressman Darden, someone you know well, former candidate for Secretary of State, he has jumped in. Very recognizable Democratic name. And a Court of Appeals judge, Sarah Doyle, who has a lot of Republican backing, is interested in the race as well. Does this become what previous Supreme Court races have become, partisan, even though it's nonpartisan on the ballot?
I don't think so, and here's why. You'll be surprised at the number of Republicans' names, big names, that John Barrow will be trotting out in the coming weeks, and also you'll be surprised at the number of Democratic names that Sarah Doyle will be coming out with. So both of them, I understand, are committed to making it a bipartisan race. Whether or not that will take place, I don't know. But both of them are working the other side. I've seen direct evidence of that.
And Barrow would seem to have an edge going in because he just ran statewide. He's well recognized statewide, as you put it, somebody who has an appeal to Republicans. He's got a B in front of his name. So
I've got to make a disclosure that I'm already announced to be with Barrow, but I think the great advantage is the person whose name is on the ballot first once you get that far down.
Yeah, and especially in a nonpartisan race.
Yeah, it depends on how much money you can spend, and it's always difficult to spend enough, particularly in a presidential year, to really scratch with voters. But I will say, historically, in the last couple of years, that Democrats, known Democrats, have won seats on the Court of Appeals or on the Supreme Court, and it hasn't been an issue. You know, Ken Hodges of Albany won a Court of Appeals seat and won it by a fairly wide margin, like 75-25 almost, over someone who was a known Republican. And John Ellington, my friend and Buddy's friend and I think everybody's friend.
Everybody's friend.
John Ellington is Justice John Ellington was on the Court of Appeals for 18 years, originally a Barnes appointee, and he waltzed onto the Supreme Court in an election last year. No known Republican people came out to run against him, and he had the endorsement of Nathan Deal and Speaker Ralston and other high-profile Republicans.
And this is a change from just a few cycles ago when Carol Hunstein and Leah Ward Sears faced visceral challenges in Supreme Court races. Those races got nasty in a way that you would think the judicial branch would want to avoid. Have we stepped back from that brink, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think what you were seeing there was a state that had been run by Democrats for 130 years, and you had this Republican majority emerge, but the remnants of the old Democratic majority still holding all these positions of power. And so you saw this emergence of this Republican backlash to that during those years. The Republicans now are in a much different situation. In the intervening years, they had supermajorities in the General Assembly. They had a huge advantage in the congressional delegation. Today, those margins are collapsing and doing it fairly quickly. It's much more competitive. But interestingly, what you're seeing here is a resurgence of Democratic might.
Congressman, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about the legacy of Justice Robert Benham. He was the first, as we mentioned, the first African-American Georgia Supreme Court justice, wrote a lot of opinions, served on the court since 1989. His is a legacy that is one of those, in this generation anyway, that would be hard to top.
It's a legacy of great honor. He was first appointed to the Court of Appeals by Governor Harris and then elevated to the Supreme Court. And he had a couple of races, but none of which were ever considered to be serious.
No, he didn't face the kind of challenges that Leah
did
Sears
not.
Did, for instance.
But he worked hard, and he's always been a man who gets the job done, who shows up for work, who doesn't try to draw attention to himself. But more importantly, he served as Chief Justice, and his fellow justices decided to waive the rules and give him an additional term as Chief Justice.
Because they have kind of a rotating system.
They did, because also at one time he was head of the National Chief Justices Association. I hosted him when Nelson Mandela came to the White House back in 94, and it was a great event for both of us. And I can't tell you the great esteem in which he is held in by both Democrats and Republicans, by liberals and conservatives, because he's quietly going about doing his job in a very nonpartisan and competent way.
One other legal note before we go. The state attorney general, Chris Carr, announced a statewide investigation, which won't be led by his office. It'll be farmed out to the prosecuting attorney's counsel, into allegations of abuse over the years by Catholic priests in the Atlanta and Savannah diocese. Chris Carr said Atlanta Archbishop Wilton Gregory encouraged the state. Gregory and Savannah Bishop Gregory Hartmeyer have promised cooperation and transparency. But digging into the history of keeping things quiet and moving priests around over the years is going to present the attorney general with some really difficult political choices, I would think, Brian, once some of that comes to light, if it's as transparent as everyone is promising it'll be.
You know, Chris is a Catholic.
He is.
And went to Marist, so he's like the real deal, goes to a Catholic church. I know that this is personally important to him as well. The Archdiocese of Atlanta has 1.2 million members. So that's a significant footprint here. So it's got far-reaching consequences. I commend Chris for taking this on. And I think what it can do for Chris politically is be part of what is becoming his brand. He is taking on sex trafficking. He is taking on this sexual abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. So you see him standing up for victims of sexual abuse, which is an emerging issue, not just in the Me Too era, I think, but even broader than that. And he is seen as a champion on those issues as a law enforcement officer. And that could be very important for him as he goes into 2022 for reelection, because it's going to be even more competitive then than it was last year.
Congressman, Atlanta, though, has had, going back some years, cases where priests were moved around. Father Anton Mowat, going back to the late 80s and early 90s, eventually pled guilty in 1990 in a case that I covered quite extensively. He pled guilty to abusing altar boys at a parish in Stone Mountain, and he had moved to England a few years before while that investigation was going on. So there is some history here.
Well, candidly, I haven't followed that closely. However, I have noticed that you're fraught with legal problems here trying to prosecute these cases due to the passage of time, including statute of limitations, which might have come up. And I think right now the investigatory process will go forward, but I don't think we'll be assured of any real results until we get a lot deeper into it. I would say that I'm an admirer of Chris Carl, so I've known him forever. I hope he'll give us an opinion pretty soon as to the constitutionality of H.R. 481, the abortion bill, too. I'd like to see his thoughts on that. But he's got a tough job, and I know he'll do his best.
Yeah, I think that this actually is something where it's important that he build his brand, because he's going to, as Attorney General, have to take stands on tough issues, ones that will be used against him in 2022. The heartbeat bill that Buddy mentioned is going to be very popular with Carr's Republican base. It's going to be a tougher issue in a general election. So taking on these issues where people are going to support what he's doing by very wide margins is important for him politically.
Plus, the Democrats consider him the senator in waiting in Georgia as well. So we'll see where that goes.
And one other figure in this is Atlanta's Archbishop Wilton Gregory, who's, although he is a churchman, is a pretty adroit politician himself. He is moving to Washington.
Which is where adroit politicians go.
Exactly.
People like Buddy.
And most people think that he will be the next cardinal.
Well, in that diocese, probably that often means a bright red hat. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, usually comes a scandal of some sort, too. It's a tricky place to be in the Catholic Church, apparently. I do want to touch on what Buddy said about Chris Carr and him being seen amongst Democrats as senator in waiting. You know, Carr was Senator Isaacson's chief of staff. Then he was appointed by deal to the Economic Development Commissioner and then to AG. Then he won election in his own right. You know, one thing I want to make clear is that there's like these two streams in Republican politics in Georgia today. It used to be the Talmadge and anti-Talmadge in the Democratic Party. You know, today you kind of have Purdue world and then this deal Isaacson world. And there's some crossover there. You know, for example, I'm married to a Purdue person who was Sonny Perdue's scheduler for a long time. And I have deep connections to Purdue world as well. But it's going to be a battle sort of between those two streams within the Republican Party, particularly if David Perdue wins re-election in 2020. You're still going to have Isaacson and then the remnants of deal world, which will fade over time. And we'll see how Kemp world emerges into those Senate discussions and if there's somebody in Kemp world who emerges as one of those folks. So those are sort of the undercurrents of what's happening in the party.
That's fascinating.
I was just about to say, that was the word. That is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, and only nerds who listen to Political Breakfast will find that fascinating, but I think it's interesting.
And we're glad they do.
Yeah, and we did. Yes, thank you, nerds. Thank you, fellow nerds. Oh, and can I say, you mentioned the Grady Fellowship at the beginning of the program, that the Political Breakfast was brought up when they introduced me at Friday at the ceremony, and then I had a young woman and her husband come up and say, "We are raging liberals. We love Political Breakfast, though." And so they were huge fans of the show. And I just want to say thank you to Hannah and her husband for coming up and saying that, because I love getting that kind of feedback.
And let me congratulate Brian, too. Whether we're on the air or not, I am so proud of his many accomplishments. This is a well-deserved honor, and no one else really deserves it more.
Thank you, buddy. I really appreciate that. Can I say one quick thing?
Sure.
Because since we don't get Buddy very often.
Yeah.
In addition to serving Georgia for many years in a variety of capacities, from the DA to the State House to Congress to being one of the wizened advisors of state politics in Democratic circles, Buddy's also married to Lillian Darden, who is the daughter of the guy who started Wesley Woods.
I was just about to bring up Wesley Woods, because that's
by
how
Emory.
I know Lillian.
Yes. And she ran it for a long time. And before our next podcast, we'll have Mother's Day, which is a huge Wesley Woods PEG every year. Right. It's where they do their fundraising and the Methodist Church throughout North Georgia to fund the benevolence programs there, the pastoral care, the wellness programs that they have at Wesley Woods. And Lillian Darden and her family's vision has delivered a real jewel of the retirement community in Georgia. And they have 10 locations in North Georgia now. And so for Methodists throughout North Georgia, get out there on Mother's Day and support Wesley Woods and Lillian Darden and her family's vision.
Nothing left to say.
And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Former Democratic Congressman Buddy Darden filled in for Theron Johnson today. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff for former Governor Nathan Deal. Gentlemen, thank you so much. This was fun.
It was great. Good to have you,
buddy. My pleasure.
And if you like this show, subscribe. And you can do that wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to rate us, too. That's a great way to make sure that other people can find us. And we will be back in your feed and in your head soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WAB politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WAB politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WAB.org or your favorite podcast platform.